Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your questions astronomy-related. You know, this show is... You never know quite where the Bob Berman episode of Vox Pop will go. It could go to the beginnings of the universe. It could go to the ends of the universe. It could go... You know, dark matter, light matter, in-between matter. We'll find out, and we'll only find out after you call. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/voxpop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We, of course, welcome your questions. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Well, after that long preamble, Bob, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ray. Good to be here. Thank you.
Nice to have you here. And, of course, we got the big comet coming, but you also have a big event locally coming up this month. Actually, it's underway, I guess.
Well, it's on Friday. It was supposed to be tonight, but fortunately, it's cloudy, and I think Friday is a better night. Just the night that we're going to have a supposed eclipse of the moon.
Okay. Oh, now explain that. You were complaining about that before we started the show.
Yeah, on Friday night, on the walkway over the Hudson, we have Stephen here, who's executive director of the Bardavon,
and it's nice to have you here.
And right over the Hudson River, what used to be a train bridge is now open to the public.
Sure.
So that's going to be cleared of riffraff. And that night it'll
yourself excluded.
No, including myself.
Okay.
And
all
that
right.
Night it'll just be for people to enjoy the sky and the lights of Poughkeepsie and the Mid-Hudson Astronomy Club. It's going to set up telescopes along the way. And I'll be talking about the wonders of the autumn sky.
Wow, terrific.
And that's this... This Friday night, and there'll even be a supposed eclipse of the moon.
But it's not really anything to write home about. At least, well, that's what you said.
It's self-defeating to admit that, because it would be great to say, yes, come everybody and we'll watch an eclipse together. But a penumbral eclipse of the moon is a very subtle thing. The moon barely changes, if at all. But it's night of the full moon. It is the hunter's moon.
Okay. And this is all part of SkyFest, Astronomy and the Arts, October 16th through November 30th. And you will be giving some lectures as well, including at the Bardavon, yes?
Yes. And at the Bardavon, maybe Stephen can tell us about that.
All right. Let's turn Stephen's microphone on, Zach the engineer. He would be on microphone number 5, let's say. Go ahead.
There we go. Hey.
Hey, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Bob, you're going to be at the Bardavon on November 19th doing a lecture about light and color in the universe, which is the second lecture you'll be doing as part of SkyFest. SkyFest is produced by the Bardavon, and it's the fall installment of the Four Seasons of the Hudson Valley Festival. So there's a whole lot of other really kind of cool events that are happening in and around that as well, including two art exhibits, SkyFest exhibit, one going to be at the Barrett Art Center in Poughkeepsie,
mm-hmm.
and that's featuring works of about astronomy with the theme of astronomy, but with the unusual and contemporary thrown into that as well. And a second one going to be at the Adrian's Memorial Library in Poughkeepsie, which has this beautiful renovated lobby space with a really incredible cupola, and we're going to be putting in a false dome underneath that. That's going to be a universe installation done by Arm of the Sea Theater, and it features all artists that are making man-made objects, such as starships and space stations and satellites. And both of those openings happen on November 2nd.
All right. Now, how can people find out more about SkyFest?
There's all kinds of information at the Bardavon website, which is www.bardavon.org. Okay. And it culminates at the Bardavon on November 23rd with the Hudson Valley Philharmonic doing a performance of The Planets by Gustav Holst. And that's going to be accompanied with digital projections that are choreographed to go along with the music. It's really going to be an amazing piece. There's some incredible, spectacular images that are part of that show.
Bardavon.org, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, now, Bob, your lecture on the 19th at the Bardavon, Light and Color in the Universe, always fascinated me because a lot of the pictures you see from deep space are false color pictures. Why is that?
Well, I think taxpayers want to get their money's worth. The real universe is kind of monochrome. First of all, there really is no color out there until we see it, because humans or mammals create color. Real light is electromagnetic radiation. Magnetism is invisible. Electricity is invisible. So what's really out there has no color, has no form. And so we're needed, observers are needed to give it color. But even beyond that, red really is what dominates, because hydrogen, the universe's most common element, glows with red. So colors like violet and blue are very rare. So, yeah, so we want to tweak them up, and NASA and JPL love to produce false colors.
Yeah. So you'll be there November 19th, and, of course, Comet Ison approaching the sun. We hope it survives, but you'll be taking a crew down south of the equator,
Yeah, in just 2 weeks, down to Chile to try to grab it first before it's destroyed. It may not be destroyed.
What do you think the odds are?
I think it'll probably survive the perihelion passage as it whips around the sun on Thanksgiving. And then, if that's the case, then the first week of December may put on a really great show. You never know with comets. They're like cats. They do what they want. But you know, we know where it's going to be, and we're going to first check it out 2 weeks from now in Chile.
Fair enough. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman, the guest, if you haven't figured that out. We go to Merle in Argyle. Merle, you're on.
All right. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
My question has to do with combining suns. Our sun is a single sun, and I heard on Sandy Wood's little commentary every morning that most stars or most suns are binary. And then she said somebody has come up with binary suns combining and making bigger sun. Well, I would think that two suns combining would be nothing left, would be a big explosion, or is it a slow process, or do you know anything about it at all?
Well, I do, and it's a new idea, really, because in some places where all you really have are old suns, old stars, such as globular clusters, we nonetheless observe a few what we call blue stragglers. Blue stars are always youthful stars because they're hotter than all the others. So how did they get there? There's no gas for which new stars could have been created. How did they get there? And the new thinking is that in this crowded atmosphere, two suns came together, two stars came together, forming a higher mass star. More mass produces more heat. And so now you have a blue, a star with a second lease on life. And so that does happen from time to time, we now believe.
All right.
But there's usually not an explosion then.
You can get an explosion from two stars. For example, a supernova is, there's two types, but one of the two types is when material from one star settles on the surface of another. But instead of just plain material, you could actually have a star coming too close to. So you could get an explosion. It all has to do with how much mass is involved. Mass dictates the whole thing. It's like what Roberto Duran said. Remember the famous line?
No mas.
Yes.
Right. Merle, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Nathan in Clarksburg, Mass. You're on.
Hi. I'm curious about how far astronomers have come in seeing and photographing black holes.
Well, you can't photograph a black hole, of course, because there's nothing to see. It would block out the light of anything beyond it. But we haven't even seen that. We haven't even seen a place where there's suddenly a gap, a black silhouette in front of a bright background. Nobody's even observed that. So this is not a visual thing. We presume black holes exist because of their gravitational effect. For example, these nights, right overhead in Cygnus the Swan, there is a faintish star. You'd need binoculars to see it. It's eighth magnitude. Goes by the catchy name of HDE226868.
Oh, nice.
And once a week, this star, won't repeat the name, gets whirled around like a sumo wrestler, whirling around a ragdoll by something. So whatever is whirling it around, this is a heavy star, weighs about 12 times what the sun does. What can hurl around a heavy star would have to be an even heavier object. And the problem is, the heavier you are, the brighter you are when you're a star. So this is a seriously underluminous object. It's got to be small because of the orbit, and it gives off X-rays, which is what theory tells us should come from that spot when a little bit of infalling, spiraling in material gets emitted, and the X-rays flicker in a period that tells us it's a very tiny object. So you put together all those clues and this spot in the sky. The only thing that makes sense is a black hole, but none have ever been seen visually or photographed.
Wouldn't you
visually
see a ring with the so-called event horizon with matter or whatever?
Love it. This is what, you know, Ray makes the perfect host here, because he really knows about this stuff. If there's a perfect alignment between a massive object, which could be a black hole, and a bright object behind it, let's say a quasar or a galaxy, then the light from the more distant object can get warped by the space-time warpage of the foreground object and produce what's called an Einstein ring.
But it hasn't happened that we've seen?
No, we've never seen that around a black hole.
Okay. Hey, Nathan, we got to take a break, but thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Glad to. Have a great one.
Bye now. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop. It's Bob Berman, boys and girls. More calls coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Washington County Tourism, presenting the annual Haunted Barn at the Little Theater on the Farm and the historic Salem Courthouse for children and adults this Friday from 6 to 9 p.m., WashingtonNYCounty.com. A show can center's Fall Family Fun Festival, cider making, pumpkin painting, nature walks, Elizabeth Mitchell, and You Are My Flower, Jay and Molly and more, Saturday, October 19th from 11 to 4, ashokencenter.org. Adirondack Creamery Ice Cream, crafted with local milk, cream, cane sugar, and eggs, featuring flavors such as cherry chocolate chip, available at Adams Farriker Farms, ShopRite, and specialty grocers. AdirondackCreamery.com. Lexington Vacuum, Albany, New York, featuring Miele, Simplicity, Dyson, Electrolux, Vapori Vapor Cleaning, Sales Service Repairs, LEXIVAC.com. And Dr. Johanni, Capital District and New York City, specializing in occupational and environmental health and prevention, including water problems, dampness, and mold problems, JohanniMD.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman is the guest. Bob, here's one from the email, I guess it is. This is from Rich Zielinski in New Jersey. Could you enlighten me, please? I have Nikon 10x50 binoculars that I've used for viewing various sky objects for years. Orion Nebula, Beehive Cluster, Jupiter's moons, all good. I decided to up the ante and get the biggest scope I could afford, Orion 8-inch reflector. But when I look at something like the Orion Nebula, it is a much better sight in the binocs, brighter, clearer. How can this be, since the reflector scope has many times the light-gathering power of the binocs? The nebula looks washed out and lackluster, as does the Andromeda Galaxy, compared to the view in the binoculars. I was expecting more detail and a brighter object in my sights. Please explain.
Actually, it's pretty simple. A telescope has a minimum magnification, and depending upon the focal length of your telescope, the minimum magnification is probably 30 or 40 power, whereas the binoculars you cited are 10 power magnification. So the lower magnification is a more appropriate and certainly will give you a sharper image on the Pleiades, on the Orion Nebula, than you're going to get on the other objects. And then there's a second factor, and that is the brightness of the image, called exit pupil. In the binoculars, your 10x50s give you a very bright exit pupil of 5 millimeters. And this just has a good degree of brightness for a nocturnal object. Your telescope, I promise you, will not, even if you use your lowest power eyepiece, you're going to have a exit pupil of 2 millimeters or less. So you will have a fainter looking image. But never expect too much detail, even if you could magnify it in the binoculars, because at low light levels, we use our scotopic, or night vision, whose best view possible is 20/200. In other words, we're legally blind when we're looking at nighttime objects through binoculars or through a telescope. 20/200 is our vision when we're using rod-based or scotopic vision. So you will not see the sharpness that you would see in a magazine photo of these same objects.
What interested me about this email is, I didn't realize you could see some of these things with binoculars. I need to get a good set.
Pleiades are or the Seven Sisters out these nights at 9 or 10 o'clock in the east. Binoculars, I think, are the best possible instrument for something like that. That's a wide field.
Andromeda, but Jupiter's moons, really?
Well, Jupiter's moons, if you hold them steady. Those are more challenging binoculars, but if you brace your elbows on a windowsill or a car hood, you can see the moons of Jupiter. That really is better in a telescope, but
okay.
you can get those.
How about rings of Saturn? All I want to see is rings of Saturn, and my telescope skills are just horrendous.
Well, that you do need a telescope. Your minimum magnification for that is 3 times greater than what this person's binoculars were. You need 30 power minimum to see the rings.
Fair enough. Let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Bob in Palinville, you're on.
Hi. I had heard you speak a few years ago about simultaneity, and I was wondering if there had been any new developments on that.
Now, are you talking about EPR correlations or entangled particles? Is that what we were talking about at that
time? Entangled particles, I believe.
Okay. Well, ever since 1998, Nicolas Gissan and his experiment in Geneva proved what Einstein had poo-pooed, which is that this quantum prediction of quantum entanglement is really real. And now much more is being done with it with practical applications just around the corner. What this essentially means is that two bits of light or two bits of matter created together can know what the other one is doing and exist in a probabilistic state that collapses to become a real particle or a real photon bit of light with matching complementary properties as its entangled twin, even if they're separated by the width of the universe. So if they're 10 billion light years apart and you observe or do an experiment with one of the twins, the other one knows what is happening in real time. In other words, you don't need the speed of light. You don't need light to convey the information. But in actual real time, the second particle knows that the first one has collapsed to, let's say, have an upspin, or if it's a bit of light, polarized horizontally, and it will instantly collapse to become a real particle or bit of light with the complementary property. And this is, you know, fantastic.
Yeah. Well, what sort of practical applications could one have for this?
In computing, because you can create quantum computers that use the entangled properties to go faster. Now, if you ask me one more question about how it's actually done.
How's it actually done?
I'll right. have to stop.
All right, let's go to Michelle in Windsor. Michelle, you're on.
Hello. You actually just touched upon part of my question. My husband and I have been reading about quantum physics just to broaden our horizons. And I've got a question about, how a particle is created when observed, and basically what is an observer? Can a camera be an observer? Can an amoeba be an observer? That's basically a question. What is this observer that can create matter?
Well, these are really good questions. And when you say create matter, what we're really talking about there is in a particular state of being. This all started with the famous double slit experiment, where you can shoot either bits of light or bits of matter like electrons towards two slits in a barrier,
exactly.
which then go through those slits and then get measured by a detector on the other side. Now, if you don't care which slit the particle went through, you just send a whole bunch of them through, what you'll find is a pattern showing waves, proving that the electrons are waves or the bits of light are waves of matter. But if instead you set up these slits so that you can determine where each of these particles or bits of light went through, that it went through this slit or this slit, you get a different result. You now get little bullet-like hits on the far side showing that the particles have now become, particles instead of waves. So you, by observing it, by learning something about it, in this case, the which way information, which way the particle has gone, just by you having the knowledge in your head, and I'm really making this the Reader's Digest version because there's been all sorts of clever ways of trying to overcome this, But no matter how you do it, whether it's by a camera or an instrument or using entangled particles to not know it directly but infer by the twin's activity what the first one's activity must be, no matter how you gain the knowledge, the actual nature of the particle or wave changes as soon as your knowledge in your mind changes. So we now think that particles or waves do not have an existence by themselves until they're observed. In other words, electrons aren't real objects with real positions or real motions. Rather, they're probabilistic, blurry things, and only when observed do they become a real object or have a real motion. So the observation determines the reality, which is why physicist John Wheeler, famous Nobel physicist, said that no object is a real object until it's an observed object. And that's what you're bringing up. That's what you're talking about. So, you know, you can bring up all sorts of questions. What if a cat did the observation? Would that be enough? What if there were nobody around? Does that mean there'd be no electrons? There'd only be a blurry state of what ifs, a probabilistic state, and things would never collapse if there's no observers? The consensus now is yes. Yes,
wow. I mean,
they wouldn't be there, that the observer is necessary to bring, what let's call it, reality into being. This is very far outside.
Well, this is why physicists drink. I mean, this is clearly. Michelle, thank you very much for that interesting call. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman is our guest. I have a tough time wrapping my head around that. I mean, there has to be something to it. Otherwise, there's nothing. There's nothing real. Yes.
Well, what you're really talking about is whether there's anything real independent of us. And the standard view, before we throw out the standard view, is that there was a dead, pre-existing universe made up of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and all these other things that are all as dumb as gravel, and they all collided with each other, you know, randomly. You know the story.
Yeah, and sure.
Gradually, by accident.
By accident.
Yep, right. Here's life. Here we are perceiving things, and gradually this dumb carbon and oxygen, here we are. It somehow acquired this taste for hot dogs and the smells of lilacs and all the rest, and this came into being from just randomly. The more modern view is that you can't really have the universe without the observers, that they go together. They're correlative. The observer and the universe are part of a single entity.
Okay.
Now, I know this crosses
unless
over.
Unless the universe has its own consciousness.
It does kind of really cross over into philosophy or metaphysics or something, but, and I'm not doing it justice here with this quick synopsis, but that's the idea. That's the debate.
Bob Berman is our guest, and we're off to the races once again at 1-800-348-2551. Greg and Gardner, you're up.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So I'm curious about astronomical photography. I picked up a Meade LX200, which is a Schmidt Cassegrain with an F10, and I'm wondering, what's the best way to go about doing photography with this?
Well, that's a big question. And do you have a good drive on that where you can track objects very well?
I don't. It didn't come with one, but I've looked into getting one. I mean, it has the, you know, it has the forks. I have to get the hand controller and the software.
Okay. Well, this is not for the faint-hearted. To take long exposure photography using a backyard telescope, you have to be polar aligned perfectly. You've got to really do this stuff. I used to be into this 20, 30 years ago. It's changed since then, because back then we used gas hypersensitized film. Now it's all digital, of course, and with CCDs.
That was one of my questions, right?
Yeah. Nowadays, everybody's using that. But to start off, just to make it easy on yourself, do bright objects. For example, the moon is a no-brainer because it's just so bright.
Yep.
You don't need tracking for the moon. You use any kind of, even with your CCDs, you'll get beautiful imagery. You'll impress everybody with that. If you start off with that and then get to the fainter and fainter objects that require tracking, that will be that'll make it easier on yourself. Yeah.
Okay. And the CCDs, you know, back in the old days, the CCDs were not nearly good enough for this sort of thing.
Yeah, and now they are. That has changed so much. But because my interest in this has been left behind by technology now. I'm no longer the person that can give up-to-date information on this.
So back in the old days, you didn't use software.
Oh, no, 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 no. I would sit in often in the cold weather for 45 minutes at a time, hand-controlling, even though we had the telescope was being tracked, but there was periodic error. There was an all-drive systems using a guide telescope and an illuminated reticle. I would track a guide star and correct for the little drifts and take a 45-minute exposure of M42, the Orion Nebula, and after 30 mess-ups, and we're talking about like virtually 30 hours of bad pictures.
An expensive film, no doubt.
Yes, and gas hybrid film, I'd have this great picture, which is hanging on my wall, and I'll send it to anybody who wants, because that's the, okay, after this.
It was worth it.
I'm going to quit.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it, Greg.
Thank you.
Bye. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Astronomer Bob Berman, our guest. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. John in Sheffield. John, you're on.
Good afternoon. I have a question as to all of the matter which is created in our fields these days for the harvest season is, in fact, sunlight photons converted into matter.
Okay, is that a question or?
Yes, no, it's a question. In other words, where does all that mass that piles up in our fields and gets harvested come from?
Oh yeah, well,
when it's all harvested, the field looks just the way it did before.
A little outside of my field of expertise, but no, you're not going to get real mass from photons only because, thanks to E equals mc squared, you would need so much energy to produce mass. We do see that happening in the universe in a place of extremely high energy, let's say a supernova, where there's energy to throw away. Yes, you'll get individual particles of mass from energy because the conversion can, you know, can work either way, mass into energy, energy into mass. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to get that from sunlight on a pumpkin field. Instead, what happens is that the sunlight, the energy of the sunlight is used, we know that, from chlorophyll and photosynthesis to supply the energy that the plants need to create sugars and starch and all the rest. And at this point, I'm just making this stuff up because it's outside my field.
Right.
But that's what happens. In other words, the energy is used as a feeding process, not as a creation of matter process.
So where does the matter come from?
Where does matter come from? Well, now we're back to, I mean, it depends upon how far back you want to go with this one. You know, you go all the way to that first moment of the Big Bang, where matter supposedly popped out of nothingness. I'm not poo-pooing the Big Bang. I'm just saying it's not the beginning of the universe. It's just the earliest event we know of.
All right.
That we know of. The earliest event we can say anything about is the entire universe's worth of matter popping out of nothingness. Now, if that satisfies you as an explanation, we're done.
Well, no, because there are great big rolls of hay in my hay field, and they weigh tons, and it's got to be more than just the water that was added. So where did it come from?
You mean originally on planet Earth?
No, I just mean between the spring and the fall. Huh. Somehow the stuff all got created and is carted away. When it's gone, it looks just the way it did last spring.
I would suspect, again, this is outside of my field of expertise, that you're getting it from the soil and it's coming up from the ground. I will tell you that the sun is 4 million tons lighter every second. Meaning that if you could, this is how much matter is being converted to energy, and you could argue that that energy has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
So that, and it's not theoretical. If you could take the sun and weigh it on a giant scale, the sun actually weighs 4 million tons less every second.
That is frightening.
As it converts itself, its mass to energy. So, you know, one who didn't know better could say, well, Earth intercepts a little tiny piece of that, and maybe some of that energy gets converted back to mass, and that's those tons of hay that you're looking at, except that wouldn't be right.
Well, John, that was an interesting call. Thank you very much. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Let's get one more call in here before the break. Patrick in Poughkeepsie. Patrick.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question regarding a multiverse theory, and I just read an article recently that claims that there is for the first time some kind of proof that could substantiate a multiverse theory, having to do with the magnetic field anomalies that they pick up that would be consistent with a multiverse. And I was just wondering, if that were the case, what kind of implications that would have for our understanding of the universe, especially things like the Big Bang, if a multiverse would make the Big Bang more, like, explainable or less.
Before you answer, Bob, just give us a quick one-liner on what he means by multiverse.
That means that our universe that we see is only one aspect or facet of other dimensions, other realities that exist, coexist
okay.
with us at the
All
same
right.
time.
So...
Oh, you want the real, the whole thing?
I want you to answer his question.
Okay.
Now we have the definition.
There's two ways to answer this. On one level, the everything we observe, that is to 13.8 billion light years away distance, although everything has expanded since then, so the edges of the universe are really 38 billion light years away now. Some say 45 billion light years. But everything we can see apparently started with a Big Bang. That's just the observable universe, but there could have been and probably were other Big Bangs coexisting with ours that exist beyond our sight. So all of these would be other universes. But the real problem, as physicists will tell you, is that we have so little data. There's so little that we can observe that all these things are speculative at this point. We are replacing hard data, which is the way science used to be done, with almost idle speculation, and
right.
multiverses is just one of them that you can count on it. A few years from now, 5 years from now, nobody will be talking about multiverses. There'll be something else that will grab attention or headlines
right.
or some other idea that you can make fit mathematically.
Right.
So I just wouldn't take any of that too seriously right now unless you enjoy speculation.
But Patrick says, no. Patrick, can you hang on until after the break?
Yeah, I have a couple minutes.
All right, hang in there. Let's take a break. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. More with Bob Berman coming up.
Support for WMC comes from the alternative baker, Rosendale. Artisan all-butter baked goods made from scratch, handcrafted lemon velvet cakes and egg sandwiches daily, where taste is everything, lemoncakes.com. Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center's Graduate School of Social Work, now offering mental health practitioners a postgraduate certificate program in military trauma treatment, adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley. The Pride Center of the Capital Region, supporting the lives of the Capital Region's LGBT community since 1970, presenting their 2013 Pride Center Gala this Friday at the Century House, CapitalPrideCenter.org. The Palace Theater, Albany, presenting the Mind, Body, and Spirit Health Fair for children and adults, featuring health clinics, healthy cooking demonstrations, and more this Sunday, PalaceAlbany.com. And Dr. Joseph Cohen, optometrist, eye examination, classic eyewear, contact lens fitting in historic Uptown Kingston, participating with MVP, Empire, Davis, VSP, Medicare, and other insurances, CohenOptometry.com.
One 800-348-2551. And of course, I hung up on Patrick just out of reflex, so I apologize.
I can finish answering.
Well, he said he had proof. There was some now proof about.
There is no proof of that. You know,
right?
You go on websites and they'll call it that. You know, if a caller asks about and says, "What's the rotation period of Mars?" There's an answer to that. It's 24 hours, 37 minutes, 23 seconds.
Okay.
There's a definite answer. But if somebody says, what is the future of the universe? What is it made of? How far can we see? Basic questions like that, cosmological questions. And you want to give them an honest answer. The honest answer is that only 4% of the visible universe is of known material, what we call baryonic matter.
No.
Atoms like planets in our bodies and things like that. 96% is unknown dark energy, which is unknown, and dark mass, which is unknown. And that's just the visible universe. We have more and more evidence that the actual universe is at least 100 times the size of the visible universe, and increasing numbers of physicists are thinking that it's actually infinite. So when you have a sample size that's as close to zero as what we have when it comes to the larger universe, the answers you give are speculative. They're not based on hard data.
Okay.
And that's the truth. So instead, too many are making up stuff.
So you're implying that then because something is unknown, it is unknowable?
It's a great, great question, Ray. I love the things that you ask. There is, if the universe is infinite, if the universe really proves to be infinite, and last year's data from the University of Berkeley is pointing that way, then it will prove that the universe as a whole is unknowable.
Okay. Well, let's go back to closer to Earth, quite a bit closer. Here's one from the email. Since the Earth is round and its shadow causes the phases of the moon, how is it that we see a half moon, which is a straight line down the middle of the moon? The other phases of the moon show the curve of the Earth, example, the crescent moon.
Right. That's a simple error that a surprising number of people make, that think that the phases of the moon are due to Earth's shadow on it. But when you think about that, our shadow has to be pointing opposite the sun at all times. And the only time the moon is ever opposite the sun is at full moon. So there is only one time of the lunar month when the moon could possibly go into our shadow, and that's a full moon, which would then, over a matter of an hour, go through some make-believe ersatz phases, which will happen next year on tax day, on April 15th, by the way. We'll actually see that happening here.
Wonderful.
From this part of the country. The other phases are not due to the moon going into our shadow. They're just simply due to seeing the moon's not fully illuminated, but being at an angle where we're only seeing half of it lit up by the sun and seeing its night side, just as we have a night side, and we're not being shadowed by some other body in the solar system.
Yeah.
Every object has a day side and a night side, and so we're just seeing the night side of the moon then. Nothing to do with Earth's shadow.
Okay, Bob Berman is our guest. Bob, I want you to take a look at the board with all the callers and the brief subjects that we have. Now, this show will have a habit of going in one bizarre direction in every program. And now we are about to start a run of questions about the hay issue. Here we go. Joe in Middleboro. Joe, you're on.
Hi, Bob. Hey, Ray.
Hey.
This is about the hay. Most of the mass comes from the air. It's carbon. That's
hey, there
why.
We go.
All right.
Great.
Carbon. You've got your hydrocarbons, so, you know, your water and your carbon and a little bit of minerals out of the ground.
Perfect.
So I hope our previous caller is listening to that. There's your answer.
Okay. Let's see if everybody else hangs up, because I think we have the same answer. Jamie in Ulster Park. Jamie, you're on.
Hi. I was actually going to say the same thing.
Well, say it anyway. Everyone hung up.
Okay. It comes from carbon. It comes from the air. That's where the mass is in all of our vegetables, all of our crops that are growing, even the mass of the trees that start from a tiny acorn, it's coming from the carbon.
Good answer.
Isn't that great? Thanks. Stuff? See, I wouldn't have, I was trying to make up an answer there.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought of that. It comes from there. Would you have?
Well, I would have just said it had something to do with a multiple universe.
Well, you know,
and,
it's interesting because this is a question that we sometimes ask children, and they often don't know the answers, but neither do the adults. So this is one of the issues that we talk about in the teacher training workshops that I help run.
Brilliant.
So it was just totally relevant. So thanks a lot.
That's
Jamie.
Great. I wouldn't have, you know, if I had a guess, where does the mass of the growing vegetables come from? I would have guessed something in the soil. Wouldn't you have,
yes,
Stephen?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of the responses are from kids and adults from different backgrounds, different levels. Yeah. Comes from the air. People don't tend to think of air as having mass, but it does.
Very interesting indeed, and I appreciate the call, Jamie. And now, oh gosh, look, all the lines are open because everybody who had the answer to the hay question hung up.
So Roberto Duran was wrong.
They're yes, Mas.
Yes.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your odds of getting through extremely good right now, and we'll field anything.
That's great.
Farming
that so many
questions.
People were answering, and with the right answer to that previous caller. That's great about where the stuff comes from. You know what I'd like to mention while we wait for the next caller is that we're doing an article in Astronomy Magazine over missing mass. That was the other caller was asking about that, which is thought to be or dark matter, as it's also called, and This is a fascinating topic that there's a new idea about. Well, it's 30 years old now, but a lot of people haven't realized it yet. Started back in 1933 when we observed other galaxies that were moving so fast they shouldn't be part of the cluster they were part of. They should have had enough speed to escape from the cluster, but they didn't.
Yeah.
Every galaxy cluster in the universe shouldn't be there, but it is. So there must be hidden gravity lurking in stuff there, at least six times more stuff than we can see. And we also found that our own Milky Way spins in such a strange way, there has to be at least a dozen times more mass, substance in the galaxy than we can see. So what is this? Can't be stars. We'd see them. Can't be black holes. They'd affect things around it. Can't be nebulae. Can't be dust. We're out of things to wonder about.
Yeah.
And so the prevailing view these days is that it's dark matter, that's the name for it, which is really made up of a new kind of particle that we haven't found yet that is invisible but has a pull, has a gravitational pull, and that six times more stuff than we can see that makes up our bodies and our planet and the stars are made up of this strange unknown material. That's become gospel now. But there's a new view, which is that dark matter doesn't exist.
And which would make sense.
And instead, this missing mass, the behavior, is being caused by gravity acting differently than we ever suspected. And that at very weak levels, when gravity falls off, instead of continuing to fall off weaker and weaker and weaker, there's a limit to how weak it can get. And that gravity itself behaves strangely.
Counterintuitive, then.
Yeah. And so in that case, there is nothing in the universe missing. And it's only gravity that acts us differently than we ever thought it did. And there's a lot of heat and tension in the astronomical community over this that I thought our listeners would like to know about, that there's really a controversy over which of these is true. Is there really dark matter or missing mass, or is it gravity that's weird?
I mean, doesn't it make more sense since gravity is so mysterious, even to those brilliant scientists who look at it, that they wouldn't have a key piece of the puzzle, and rather than postulating there is all this dark matter that, oh, by the way, we can't see it or measure it, or gosh, we have no way of proving it's there, but it better be there because we know everything about gravity.
Well said. Exactly, well said. That's what, and it's only maybe 10% of astronomers who believe in this gravity solution. But we just got a boost this year, when stars. You know how our galaxy is like a flat plane, a disk,
yeah,
a vinyl record.
That's what they say.
Well, measuring stars that are at high latitudes above and below the flat plane. You know, in other words, straggler stars. Their motions are such that if dark matter existed, and dark matter, if it exists, should be preferentially in a halo in that very area. But nothing's pulling on this material up there. So this gives now powerful support for the odd gravity idea, whose name is Mond, by the way.
Mond.
It has a name, M-O-N-D, Modified Newtonian Dynamics.
So does that
theory
make Einstein right or wrong?
Not really, because he didn't really vote on Newton's saying that gravity falls off inversely with the square of distance the way we were taught at school. It's just a little tweak.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones and David in Woodstock. David, you're on.
Hi. I understood you to say earlier in the show that things in the universe did not exist until they are observed. Well, it strikes me, the question is who is the observer? And it strikes me that most of the universe could not have been observed before the evolution of modern science and the rise of astronomers like yourself. And so what you're really saying is that the universe didn't exist until you, the astronomer, observed it. And I find that a little bit elitist.
Well, you know, I don't know if it's elitist, but I'll grant you that it really doesn't make sense. And you have a problem with it. I have a problem with it. I'm not advocating it. But if you look up John Wheeler or the Anthropic Principle or do a search of this on your own, you'll see why they say that the universe and the observer are correlative. If you look at
wait a minute. This is my problem right now, because you're using the term the observer in the abstract, when what's really happening is you're citing a very small class of highly trained professional astronomers and theorists who did not exist prior to the previous last century, at least. Okay, and so what you're saying is that the universe could not have existed until this small class of theorists and observers came along.
I'm not saying
it's
that.
It's not possible.
I'm not advocating that. Look up the double slit experiment. See if you come up with better ideas on your own for why we're observing what we're observing. Come to your own conclusions. I'm not pushing any one or the other.
One thing we have a lot of on this show is ambiguity, and we never have an answer for anything. And frankly, I think what we're talking about is the observer is you, me, anybody who observes, then it becomes matter. It's not a scientist. Once there were scientists, then things became real.
There is a certain illogic in it. I grant the caller that. There
David,
is illogic.
Great call. I appreciate it. Let's go over to Dwayne in Albany. Dwayne, you're on.
Hello?
Hello.
Hey, okay, I couldn't hear you say my name.
Hello, right, Dwayne. Well,
this is all pretty freaky stuff. I agree with the last caller, and I mean, I believe that. Bob, what did you say the name of that experiment was? The Devil's Foot?
The Double
The slit. Devil's Foot. That's even better.
No, I like that, but
double
that should change
split.
It.
Double Split.
No, Double, you know, like.
Devil's Foot. Yeah. Okay.
Double,
thanks.
Like Double Trouble, and Slit.
Okay.
Like,
I wish.
Yep.
I wish it was the Devil's Foot.
Yeah, but anyway, that's great.
I guess it reminds me a little bit of, I think, if I recall correctly, I read a long time ago then in The Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and I think it was, if I recall correctly, it was about a scientist that kind of went nuts because he was considering all these questions of the universe. If I'm wrong about that, it doesn't really matter. My question is, has that really happened? I mean, you know, some of these quantum physicists that are considering these questions, and they're so theoretical and so crazy. They're really getting into things that are like... more like philosophy and religion.
No, I agree. It's definitely crossing the line there, but I'd like to stick to the practical, and so would you, obviously. So look it up. Look, see why John Wheeler said what he did. Look at the double slit. Really get into this and see why what we're trying to figure out when we see electrons or photons or objects that change their characteristics depending upon whether they're observed or not, what that means in terms of the observer's role in the physical universe, in reality, and come to your own conclusions about it. I'm not going to push any conclusions there, but you need to look into it on your own. Be satisfied for yourself.
No, I'm actually just asking a historical question, which is, to your knowledge, have any scientists actually made the leap from science to spirituality, you know, in any kind of way that's describable because of this kind of stuff? I mean, you know.
Interesting. Interesting question. Because, you know, in a way, you're right. It's going to the point of where it seems like magic.
It does. And it's old. George Berkeley, for whom the campus and the town were named, liked to say that the only thing we can ever perceive are our perceptions.
Right. And people have been saying that forever.
So
reality.
You know, and then we assume things about the external reality that our perceptions correspond to. So this is an old issue.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
We've reached that lava lamp moment again on the program. We usually do that. Let's go to Sam in Greenfield, Mass. Sam.
Yes. For the previous caller there, and then I have a question on gravity.
All right, Greg, we got about a minute and a half, so go ahead.
Okay. It's sort of like, you know, if the tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it, did it make a sound?
Do you think it does?
One of those things you can kind of prove or disprove, right?
Right. Well, let's get to your other question.
We only
have a minute here.
On gravity, I've always been curious. I weigh so much on Earth, but on the moon I weigh less because the mass of the moon exerts less gravitational force because its mass is less. What if I'm halfway between the Earth and halfway between the moon? At that point, since gravity drops off inversely to the square distance, I think it is, I'm halfway between the Earth and the moon. If the Earth is exerting less gravitational force on me, the Earth might be exerting a little more because I'm closer to the Earth. Would I weigh less at that point in space?
Yeah, the balancing point is about 10 times the distance. You'd have to go a 10-to-1 ratio between Earth and the moon because the moon weighs 81 times less than we do, and it's an inverse square thing with the way gravity falls off.
Yeah.
So there is a balancing point. The Apollo astronauts experienced that where they stopped being decelerated. Remember, they were drifting. They had no engines firing. They were stopped being decelerated, and they started being accelerated to the moon. But you've got to get to it's about a 10-to-1 ratio towards the moon. It's not in the midpoint.
Okay, so it's a lot of effort to go through for a diet. But Sam, we're out of time here, and thank you very much. And thanks to everybody who called in. Support comes from HMT at the Spa Little Theater, presenting the musical comedy The Drowsy Chaperone, weekends through October 27th in the Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org, the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, protecting New York's historic buildings, districts, and landscapes since 1974, preservenys.org, and Lotus Fine Art and Design, Woodstock, reverse painted glass lighting, artisan crafted jewelry and gifts for all occasions, paintings and custom jewelry, Lotus Woodwork, Woodstock.com. Thanks to everybody who called in. Sorry if you didn't make it through. Zach, the engineer, did a great job. Colleen O'Connell answered the phones. Tom Jobe handled the web side of things. Jessica Blaustein Marshall is our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Thanks again to Bob Berman. And don't forget, Skyfest, you can find out more at bardavon.org. It's going on later this week and into late November. Yes. All right, everybody, stand by for news.